On this week's 51%, a musician speaks to Aretha Franklin's accomplishments.
I think the thing that made Aretha Franklin great was that she was so unapologetically herself all the time.
Hear from the head of a farm sanctuary about how she's adapting to the times, and learn why Section 377 is in the spotlight in India. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Franklin is the singer here. It was Otis Redding who actually wrote the lyrics and first recorded the song. Franklin came along and made it her own, transforming the song that leads even the inhibited into singing along at the top of their lungs into what would become a feminist anthem. And it's a song with relevance no matter the times in which we find ourselves. In You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, Franklin sang about a lover, but made the song a celebration of womanhood itself. And Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves, a duet with the Eurythmics, also resonates with women and has been covered by a slew of female artists. Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, died August 16th at age 76 from pancreatic cancer. She is being remembered as a gospel and pop giant and a civil rights beacon. Justin Patch is a postdoctoral fellow in music at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. A musician himself, Patch specializes in the intersection of music and American politics, and he spoke with 51%'s Ian Pickus the week Franklin died. Patch begins with his reaction to the loss of Aretha Franklin.
Well, it's a combination of joy and sadness. Obviously, somebody who is such a profound musician and musical presence, it's always sad when they leave. But in the last 48 hours or so, I've been talking about her with people I know and listening to her music. And it's amazing. And the way that people talk about her with incredible reverence and affection, and the way that her sound became part of people's lives, the only reaction to a life like that is joy.
Upon her death, you wrote that she's an artist who changed the way fans listen to music. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's one of these things that we learn about the possibilities of expression by hearing or by reading, or by seeing what other people do. And I think that the way that Aretha Franklin took, gospel and religious music and put it into popular music, she was not the first person to do that. You know, Sam Cooke and Etta James and all these other artists before, but she's somebody that brought that sound into people's living rooms, into people's cars, in a way that people really hadn't. You know, no one else really had that sort of reach before her. And I think that was very special, to the point where when she released a gospel album, people who weren't necessarily religious went out and bought it because they were so fascinated by the sound of her voice. And I think that she took the potential for that sort of musicianship and really put it onto the airwaves in a way that was very, very special.
You specialize in, music and the intersection with American politics, and a lot of people this week have been remarking on the fact that she did live to perform at the inauguration of the first African-American president. After the 60s and through this week, where do you think her legacy sits now in terms of, the way the country moved politically in the last half century?
Oof. That's... I think I would have had a very different answer for you 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think her legacy when it comes to advocating for civil rights and for human liberation on the whole is something that I think we're still unpacking. I mean, I read an article 2 days ago about her saying she was ready to put up bail for Angela Davis when Angela Davis was being held in New York, and the way that she explained her advocacy for Professor Davis was that, hey, this is a strong black woman who is for the liberation of black people and for human freedom, and I have to get behind that. And so that legacy of really caring about respect, I mean, her sort of signature song and the way that she advocated for human dignity and for women's rights and for civil rights throughout her career is something that I think we will look back on in 10 or 15 years and say that she was one of these incredible sort of shining beacons for 60 years of her life, and that her legacy, regardless of what went on around her, whether it was, you know, the riots in Watts and Newark and Detroit, or whether it was, you know, white supremacists in Charlottesville, that will look at her and listen to her music and say, this is what it means to be dedicated to the cause of liberation. And that's not going to change.
A lot of people, of course, have been remarking on the unique quality of her singing voice. But as a musician yourself, what can you tell us about her playing? Because she was known to, you know, accompany herself on several very important recordings.
Well, I was just listening to her recording of Sam Cooke's You Send Me this morning. And if you want to hear a very concise demonstration of her musicianship as a keyboard player, that's about as good an example as I can possibly give you. I mean, the uniqueness of her phrasing, the way that she uses the full range of dynamics. She goes from loud to soft. She uses these incredible passing chords. And the way that she uses her voice, which is what everybody knows, what everyone listens for, if you go back to those Atlantic recordings when she's playing piano for herself, you hear the way that she uses both instruments together, her voice and the piano, and the way the piano supports her voice and plays these really great sort of offbeat accents and really bolsters a very unusual signature way of phrasing that only Aretha Franklin can actually ever sort of sing a musical line like that. And it's as equally important that she supports her own singing by accompanying herself. It sounds like the most natural thing in the world to be able to, you know, play and sing at the same time. But there are very few people that really are able to step out and make a song their own on two instruments at the same time. And Aretha Franklin was one of those people who was able to do that.
Lastly, do you see an heir to Aretha Franklin in current music?
Well, I don't, and that's partially because I don't think anyone should ever try to sing like Aretha Franklin. I think the thing that made Aretha Franklin great was that she was so unapologetically herself all the time. And that's what made her presentation so incredible and so memorable, is that she wasn't trying to sound like anybody else. And I think if we get one takeaway from her, is that, like, take who you are unapologetically and make it musical. And that's exactly what she did.
Darling, you send me. Darling, you send me. Darling, you send me. Honey, you do, honey, you do, honey, you do.
That was Justin Patch, a postdoctoral fellow in music at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. Weaving animal advocacy issues with social justice issues is something Rachel McChrystal sees as integral to getting out her organization's message. She's the executive director of the Woodstock Farm Sanctuary in High Falls, New York. And I spoke with her about this and other ways to ensure the sanctuary is as progressive and inclusive as possible.
I think we are in the really unique position of introducing people to these animals that we call farmed animals in either the first time for people or in an entirely new space. So even people that have grown up, we're in a rural area, so even people that have grown up here and maybe have been exposed to farmed animals, they've never seen them as individuals, and they've never seen them as beings that are worthy of consideration and compassion. And so what sanctuary work does is we provide a space to see them just like you would meeting a dog and a cat in a house. Provide a space to meet a pig or a chicken or a turkey in their home and in their own space where they're comfortable. And what we're hoping to do is that you make that connection and then people will think twice before they eat them or consume their byproducts or even think about the day-to-day things, decisions that we make every day that impact the very lives of other beings. Once you actually meet a turkey and have a turkey like our oldest girl, Beatrice, who's 8, come up to you and hug you and you have that connection, you'll never be able to sit down at your Thanksgiving dinner with your family and see the turkey on your plate the same way. It's radical empathy and breaking down that all those walls that are between us and these animals.
Devil's advocate, I do believe there are people who will come here and they eat meat and they enjoy the experience and they're going to go home and eat meat.
Of course, definitely. We do post-tour surveys, and for people that aren't already vegan, which is about a quarter of the people who visit, are, you know, trying to expose their family to this way of thinking, or they're really just wanting to spend time with their friends and it's a return visit. But the people that aren't already 100% there, 90% of them say that they're going to either reduce or eliminate animal consumption in their diets. When we used to give these tours, we would talk about cheese a lot because I'm a white lady. I'm 36. Cheese was literally the last thing I gave up. And so it's very natural for me as the person who's determining a lot of this messaging to think like, oh yeah, cheese, it's really, you know, it's so hard to give up. And not keeping in mind that actually most people on this planet are lactose intolerant. And most other ethnicities actually are lactose intolerant. And so even my talking about cheese and then offering alternatives, most of them are very expensive. So we used to have, as part of our tour script, offering a cheese that I'm not going to name that's fabulous, but it's a nut-based cheese that's like $10 for a little bit of cheese. And that is so very exclusionary if you don't have the money to buy that or if cheese is not that important to you. So just even analyzing that, how we're presenting this rights movement as a rights movement that everyone can really take part in and that is very expansive versus exclusionary.
So that's really interesting. So what would replace the cheese example then, or what has? And it's not that you still use the cheese, but maybe you intersperse it with the other examples.
So what we've had our humane educators do is speak more about the animal experience and about what happens to the animals in these systems of oppression and in industrial animal agriculture, and then ask people for any input they personally have about what they are having problems giving up. So that if someone is, you know, instead of just putting our own experience on everybody and saying, well, I really love this. I mean, I had a hard time giving up lox. That's a very unique experience, right? Most people, that's not the thing they're going to think about. So really allowing the space for people to say like, well, this is the food that I eat a lot of. What would you recommend I replace this with? Instead of pushing our own perspective on everybody.
What's new? What is it you want to start doing that you kind of on your list of things to do, if you will?
Yeah. So we're in the Hudson Valley. The Hudson Valley is a very white area, and animal rights has been a very white dominated area. Although veganism is not a white thing. There's lots of cultures where veganism is just how you eat naturally. So what we're trying to do is actually really have Woodstock Sanctuary be representative of different communities. And so what we actually did was we started at our board level by inviting people in our community that are persons of color to actually have board leadership positions and influence what we're doing in terms of programming and decisions, which influences hiring, which influences our visitors. I mean, just when I look at how the faces of our visitors have changed over the last 4 years, we've become way more diverse, and we're really trying to connect animal rights in with other social justice movements, because that's where we see it. I think it's a little controversial, and it means that I get in way more arguments on the internet than I would like. but we're talking about systems of oppression, and we're talking about beings that are otherized and are being used, and their very bodies are being used under this system of oppression. And so you can make a lot of analogies to other social justice movements. So we've put out some statements about what's happening at our border with immigration and babies being taken away from their mothers. We marched in Pride this year in New York, and we handed out 6,000 flyers featuring Colin and Woody, our two rescued dairy calves, and talking about what happens to them in the dairy industry, really trying to get in front of folks that we think will be like-minded and really expand veganism and animal rights. We're running a farm sanctuary, period. But if we can't make some basic stands and advocate for other things, we look a little out of touch, especially when there's so much going on around us. And I think it's really easy for people to say then, okay, we'll worry about the cows when we're done with worrying about border issues. You know, even, you know, when we think about the Me Too movement, like even trying to analyze how we show up as a sanctuary in that space too, like what is our sexual harassment policies? Are we of, you know, how are we taking care of people, you know, making sure that people are being well taken care of at the sanctuary? Just being able to like try to be as transparent and kind in all of our actions.
Did you write policy or did you put something in a handbook or something
because of us? We did.
What'd you
do? So we actually we redid our sexual harassment policy completely based on a template from friends of ours at a group called Vegan Outreach that basically covers all gender discrimination, sexual harassment.
Is this an area of animal rights and especially sanctuary life that's female dominated in terms of the upper level positions?
That's a really good question. So the faces of our movement tend to be men and the workers of our movement tend to be women.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised.
Yeah. And I would say that the exception of that tends to be sanctuaries where it is more female led. But if you look at animal rights as a whole, the people that are in the big moneyed organization tend to be white men.
Down the road, McChrystal thinks a lot about being financially sustainable and how to foster this.
So we are doing rentals right now for weddings. And we also, when you drove onto the property, you probably saw that we're building a new building. It's going to be an inn. So it's, yeah, so we're actually going to, we can have overnight visitors and people that either are members here or volunteers or people that are just looking to be tourists in the area can stay at the inn overnight and get a good vegan breakfast in the morning, take a tour of the sanctuary, things like that to try to really bring in other sources of revenue.
That was Woodstock Farm Sanctuary Executive Director Rachel McChrystal speaking from the sanctuary in High Falls, New York. Next, we'll learn about Section 377 from KALW Sandeep Roy.
Five judges on India's Supreme Court just heard six petitions challenging a law that criminalizes homosexual sex, Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code, on the books since the British introduced it in 1861. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. The Indian government told the court, which began hearings on July 10th, that it would leave it to the judges to decide whether Section 377 violates fundamental rights to life, liberty, and personal security as long as it avoids broader issues like marriage, inheritance, and adoption. Social media and newspapers are abuzz with talk about Section 377. But LGBT life in India has long bypassed the law. Last week, I got a message about Pink Coffee, a gay get-together at a cafe in Kolkata. A few weeks earlier, Varta, a local nonprofit, launched an online database of LGBT-friendly therapists, doctors, and legal aid providers in India. This is a very different India from the one I came out in. The first gay Indian I ever met was Siddharth, a lanky young man with charmingly crooked teeth. My senior at school in Kolkata, he had recently returned from university abroad. We met on our old school grounds one evening, talking, smelling the bruised grass of the fields where we played as boys. He told me about escapades in New York and parties in his rooftop apartment in New Delhi where drag queens danced on a moonlit terrace. I listened, wide-eyed at his cosmopolitanism and nervous about his daring. On the way out, we ran into our old teacher, a priest in a cassock. I flinched as if we had been outed. When I went to study computer science in Southern Illinois in the 1990s, I was pursuing the American dream. My family did not know that embedded in that dream was also the secret promise of a different kind of freedom in the anonymity of a country where no one knew my name. My small Midwestern university town had a gay bar. The first time I saw one of the university professors calmly drinking beer there, I was shocked. I remember standing nervously outside an LGBT students meeting at the student center wishing it did not have that paper with LGBT support group 6 to 8 p.m. written so nakedly on it. My diffidence feels out of place in the far more assertive India I returned to in 2011. There are boisterous pride marches and LGBT film festivals. The country has come a long way from 2001, when the petition against Section 377 had to be filed by an AIDS advocacy organization because no queer person was willing to stand up in court and say, I am gay and this law affects me. India's Supreme Court is playing catch-up in a society that seems to have largely moved on. Though most politicians do not want to touch Section 377, it's viewed by many as a blot on India's idea of itself as a liberal democracy. If once activists looked at Lawrence versus Texas in the U.S. Supreme Court for hope, now they feel the world is looking at India, hoping that the court will do the right thing. If Section 377 falls, there will be celebrations, not just in India, but also in San Francisco, Toronto, and London. But even if the court repeals the law, Indian society still must contend with the deep and insidious stigma of being queer. In June, two women, both married to men, flung themselves off a bridge in the western state of Gujarat. They left behind a note saying, "We are leaving the world which will never allow us to be one." These women did not come to LGBT parties in luxury hotels. They found no support groups through smartphone apps. Repealing the law criminalizing homosexual sex will not save young men and women like them overnight, but it is a first and necessary step. Gay life grows stubbornly, like weeds in the cracks, no matter how much a law tries to stamp it out. My friend Siddharth was always arguing against all odds that change was possible. In the first Citizens Report on Homosexuality in 1991, which he co-wrote, he demanded the right to same-sex marriage, which seemed then like asking for the moon. But if Section 377 falls, even that horizon feels within reach. Siddharth will not be there to see it. He died much too young, felled by Hodgkin's disease. But I can still hear him telling me, stay in America for your education and your career if you need to. You don't have to stay away because you're gay. Things will change here. Believe me. I didn't quite believe him then. I certainly did not dare to think that one day the Supreme Court of India might be poised to deliver that reassurance. Not just for gay millionaires who can party in Delhi and marry in Paris, but also for young men and women in small-town India. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
The London Fire Brigade wants the media to stop depicting firefighters as hunky sex objects. The service says the images are sexist and deter women from joining the profession. The brigade has criticized reality TV show Love Island for including a fireman challenge in which male contestants had to strip down and pretend to rescue a woman in danger. Commissioner Danny Cotton, the first woman to lead the British capital's fire brigade, said the depiction reinforces the misconception that all firefighters are muscle-bound men. The brigade also criticizes advertisements for depicting firefighting as a man's job, including an ad for a toilet cleaner in which women objectify a male firefighter. Just 300 of the brigade's 5,000 operational firefighters are women, a number managers want to increase. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1519.